This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Looking to start a side hustle or become your own boss? Do it with Shopify. Whether you're selling succulents or stilettos, Shopify has the industry-leading tools to help you create, control, and grow your own business. So get serious about selling and get Shopify today. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.co.uk/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.co.uk/special offer.
Welcome back to Immigrantly, the podcast where we unravel the rich tapestry of immigrant stories and go beyond surface level narratives to really explore who we are. I'm your host, Sadia Khan, and today's episode is going to be a special one. Our today's guest is Myra Flynn, an acclaimed singer, songwriter, storyteller, and the host of the podcast Homegoing.
What's up, everybody? I'm Myra Flynn, musician and reporter at Vermont Public. And if you're listening to this, welcome. You're officially my very first listeners to Homegoings, a righteous space for art and race. And now, its own show. Woo! Finally. Woo-hoo.
Myra's artistry, both in her music and her podcast, boldly challenges stereotypes and invites us to look at identity through a more nuanced, inclusive lens. I have talked about stereotypes on this podcast a lot, right? And sometimes even seemingly positive ones like the model minority myth can really trap us in boxes, forcing us to fit a narrow set of expectations. High achieving, academically successful, perfectly assimilated. But these narratives leave so many of us out. They erase those whose lives don't fit neatly into these parameters, right? Whose stories are just as powerful and whose experiences are just as valid. Through Homegoings, Myra reclaims spaces for those voices, offering a powerful exploration of what it means to exist beyond the confines of a singular story. Myra and I will be talking about her journey as a woman of color, the themes she explores in Homegoings, and how her multifaceted identity shapes both her lyrics and her conversations. How does she really create art that defies expectations? And how does she balance sharing her truth with resisting the pressure to conform? But before we dive in, a quick reminder. If you enjoy Immigrantly, please don't forget to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and leave us a review. We have a whole channel of all our podcasts, 6 of them. Your support helps us continue to bring you these incredible stories like this one. So without further ado, let's get started. Welcome to Immigrantly, Myra. I'm so excited.
I'm so excited. Thank you for having me. I'm so happy we worked out these tech issues.
I know.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
I've been listening to Homegoings. Like, I've been binge listening to it. And let me tell you, your conversations are so profound, important, uncomfortable at times, vulnerable, yes. I mean, the podcast is such a safe and important space to have conversations that others are not having. And we will talk about the podcast itself. But before that, I want to say something that I've been thinking of, meaning to tell you. Your voice, oh my gosh, you have a perfect podcast voice.
That's really sweet. And yeah, to my surprise, I do get that a lot. And you know what's funny is because I've been a singer for such a long time, like 23 years, I actually have a lot of vocal damage in my vocal cords. Not quite at the stage of polyps, but I have a lot of other things going on in there that kind of make it so my voice can't project very loudly. So when I record my speaking voice, I kind of have to eat the mic. I have to get like right on it. And I think that's why people like it, is because it's soft and it's like really up close and personal. But in my mind, every time somebody says they like my voice, I'm kind of like, wow, I can't believe that, because it's a pain point for me. My voice is a pain point for me at this point in my life. Yeah, I wish it could be louder. But hey, if it makes people feel comfortable and held, and especially with some of the things that we talk about on Homegoings, you know, for people to feel safe, then that's great if my voice can be another tool for that. So thank you.
It absolutely is. And Myra, I love your name. It's a common name in Pakistan, believe it or not. Who named you Myra? And what is the meaning?
My name was my grandmother's name. And I don't know that I was named after her. I think my parents just decided they really loved her name as well. And so, and she's one of my very favorite people, rest in peace. So I'm happy to be named after her. And it means quite a few things in different cultures and different languages. For the most part, it's a derivative of Mary in a lot of different cultures. So it's very biblical. But the Hebrew definition I tend to love the most, which is quiet song. So I'll take it.
So let's start with your podcast. Now, you've mentioned in your podcast that you talk about stereotypes and you call them stereo-antitypes, right? What does that mean?
Yeah, so my podcast is Homegoings. It's 2 seasons old, not to be confused with Homecomings. It's Homegoings, which is actually a traditional African-American funeral, is called a homegoing. And a homegoing is both filled with mourning and sadness and also immense amount of joy. There's lots of art and lots of food and lots of celebration of life. And so I named the show Homegoings because I feel like it holds both of those things, joy and mourning, which is the Black experience in America. You are always kind of holding both of those things all the time. And so I did a mini series on homegoings. Typically, it's just called A Righteous Space for Art and Race. And we just talk about really intense topics. I've interviewed Rachel Dolezal about the subject of transracialism. You know, there's nothing that we shy away from. But recently, I really felt compelled to make a series on stereotypes, just because they're so profound, they're so prolific, and they're so alive and well today, and they have such a huge impact on the ways in which we are and are not able to move forward when it comes to our own anti-racist existence. And I was kind of thinking about the anti-types being like the anti-hero, like the heroes that you don't typically expect, you know, in most storybooks, in most stories in life, are the people who buck the systems that they were born into. And so I kind of went to go research some of the most intense stereotypes to start the series with, most profound ones.
Ones like this one. The one about all Black men being dangerous, harmful, menacing, or scary.
With the deep voice, especially with my appearance, when I speak, they're like, whoa, like, now you already think that I'm scary, and now you hear the voice that has a rumble to it. Now I'm extra scary.
And ended up running into Black men. And these men were really, really being impacted by stereotypes in ways that were really life-threatening and life-harming. So I decided to unpack the myth of the deadbeat dad and speak with a couple Black men who actually are wonderful fathers, but what they've had to overcome, including the absence of their own Black fathers, to show up as fathers was just horrible and beautiful. But also the myth of the scary Black man was really important, it felt, to build out. You know, Black men who have been incarcerated, there's, you know, I won't ruin it for anyone, but this Black man who was incarcerated for selling marijuana, who went on with his big Black scary voice to be picked up as a podcaster and a voiceover artist, and now has a podcast about cannabis. So like full circle. The myth of the stupid Black person, which actually has a lot of science-based racism about the studies of our brains. And while we were on the body and we were getting to the body, the most recent one, which is an uncomfortable one, but a necessary one, the myth of the big Black penis.
Hmm.
Which actually really does relate to the myth of the stupid black person as well, because there was a theory that our brains were smaller, but our genitals were enlarged. And because of this, there was all sorts of testing done for syphilis and, you know, things without our permission and done on bodies without anesthesia. And so the male genitalia and the expectation of slaves to father a certain number of children by the age of 15, it is a horrible stereotype that's hard to recognize because it's dressed up as a compliment, right? And so I had to fight pretty hard to get that episode out.
Why?
Sex. People in America anyway, just have a really hard time talking about sex and hearing about sex. And I found that really interesting because Homegoings often covers slavery, torture, rape culture, these really horrible things that have come by way of being black in America. But the minute I said penis, you know, it turned into a totally different conversation. And so I think that's always a good opportunity for us in public media, in media, to check our biases and see what's up there. But it took a while to try to convince folks and show folks really through the work that this is really not an episode about a penis at all.
Exactly. And you're absolutely right. These conversations are uncomfortable. And I was listening to this episode, and while uncomfortable, I'm so glad you did this episode because there is so much knowledge that an ordinary person wouldn't know about. These conversations are important to have. But Myra, I want to circle back to what you said about stereotypes sometimes being positive, right? Perception of a stereotype that may be misconstrued as a positive stereotype, and it can be extremely harmful. When I think of stereotypes around Asian identity, model minority is one, right? And as a South Asian, I feel like from my own experiences, sometimes we lean into these harmful stereotypes because we think they make us more visible in a very skewed, warped way. And I'm really curious to know if there was ever a moment for you where you were really tempted to lean into a stereotype for visibility, and how did you resist or reshape that narrative?
Well, for Black women, you know, there's the Jezebel trope, right? That we're all just eager and sexually wanting and born hypersexual. And it's awful, but like the idea of like, you can't really rape a Black woman, right? Because she's already born wanting this. It's a horrible stereotype when you know about it, when you understand where that comes from, but how it shows up and how it can show up, especially as a lighter skinned Black woman, and the privilege that comes with that, is our country has a real curiosity and appetite for the biracial, sexy, light skinned, somewhat approachable, but also still a little taboo Black woman. And I would say as a musician, that has granted me favors in certain rooms.
Give me an example.
Well, if people find that that is attractive and that is sexy, then people are more willing to market you, or maybe more willing to work with you or record with you because they like the whole package. And, you know, we did do an episode about Black women in the music industry, you know, surviving the spotlight. And I speak about my own sexual assault story at the top of that episode, which was really difficult and also important. But, you know, that's the thing. Like, that's the double-edged sword, I mean, that we speak about in the myth of the big black penis as well. It's like, it's all fun and games until someone gets raped. It's all fun and games until someone gets incarcerated. You know, it's awesome that you're this like 6'5" Black man with a deep voice. Aren't you so cool? Isn't it so rad that you know the hip hop and that you walk with that swagger until you're in jail for doing something menial? Right. So, you know, it's really interesting with this series. I almost completely forgot about white people while making it. And I never do that because majority of podcast listeners, whether we like it or not, are still a white audience. And so there has to be kind of have like a tender handholding of learning. I want white people who don't know some of these things to feel safe to come back to the podcast to learn them. Right. So I often have a lot of scripting that's like, in case you don't know what this means, blah, 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 blah. But not in these series. I just wanted to talk to Black people about how these stereotypes have harmed and affect them, how they've fucked them, and then what we can do for them. And I really want Black people to listen to this miniseries because I really, truly made it for us.
So I have so many thoughts on this. One, Why do you think you forgot about white people, especially for this series?
I don't want the conclusion of every episode to land on, well, this is bad, but we still have more work to do and we can do it. You know, I don't want it to land on that. I want it to stick with Black men.
Why?
Well, why? Because then why make a podcast at all? You don't have to keep beating that that drum. I don't know. Sometimes I'm a big believer in like, stop talking about doing the work and just do it. So for me, the podcast is just doing it. Just do the work. And what is the work, right? For me, it's humanizing Black people, no matter what. Whether that's with storytelling, whether it's with something like the Rachel Dolezal episode, which is very stressful because it's argued over time whether or not Rachel is a person of color, even though she identifies culturally as Black. But isn't that a podcast for Black people to also look at and say, wow, like transracialism, what is it like for somebody to try to enter our space that we've had to fight so hard to exist in, right? And I just think it's important for the stereotypes episode for Black men who are listening, like the Black men on my front porch who start at the top of the episode who are bragging about their penis size, to be like, look, like this is not a good thing. This is not a good thing for you, your body, your love, the way that you're treated. So I really hope that it's for us. And then also, you know, in the Asian community, like we had a moment where King Noir mentioned like Asian people dealing with this stereotype of like, you have all the answers, you're smart. And then of course there's other like bodily stereotypes that come along with being Asian as well.
Especially East Asian folks.
Yes, especially East Asian folks. So it is not just for Black people. I think we can tease out our own individual experiences, no matter what you've come from, of the stereotypes. And for white people who are listening, to just understand like there might be like the dumb blonde stereotype or just all sorts of sexism really that comes by way of stereotypes and how that shows up in the workforce. But to be killed, mutilated, maimed, tortured, kept from your dreams, kept from the realities of true and essential love because of these stereotypes, it's so different and it's so important to hear about.
Oh my gosh, Myra, I was going to ask you as a follow-up question, how are stereotypes for white people different in how they show up, in how they manifest, versus stereotypes for people of color? Because a lot of times, white people will say things like, oh yeah, but we are also stereotyped, right?
One thing white people need to understand first and foremost is that like, you are still and have always been the master of your own perceptions. Like, you can change them. it's not to say that you can't change systems, right? Systems are difficult for all of us, I believe. So when it comes to stereotypes, you know, let's go with the dumb blonde stereotype. Like, if you're blonde, you're not smart. You can dye your hair and have a different experience altogether. There's change that you can make. Not that you should have to.
But I do wonder if being a dumb blonde limits somebody's prospects of getting a job or succeeding in their career.
I mean, yes, that's just an example. We could delve into some other ones as well. But from what I understand about the blonde white woman, there's a lot of association with youth there and a lot of strange sexual association with youth, because when we are all babies and young, we have lighter hair and lighter skin. And it just goes really, really deep. So we could go there. Listen, if some white people want to make a show about their stereotypes, I'm here for it. And also, just to note that, okay, even if this is outdated, you know, there are some blonde women in power, there are still some people dealing with this. The reality is, worst case scenario, maybe it keeps you from getting a job. Worst case scenario, maybe you are sexually harassed, which is horrific and nobody should deal with that. But the ongoing myth and stereotype, for instance, that has been scientifically studied and proven on Black bodies that we feel less pain, has made it so that Black women and children are 3 times today more likely to die in childbirth.
In 2024.
In 2024. And that was a stat I had to do a double take at. You know, I pulled in our data journalist and just fact checked everything because I almost couldn't believe it. And what's so interesting, the myth of the big Black penis, even while making this episode with the people I've been making it with and, you know, talking to people about it, data shows that Black men do not have larger penises. And even these people were like, no way. I still believe that to be true. I still think that that's true.
Were they disappointed?
To be fair, that just came out last week, so your feedback is some of the first I've heard. Were you disappointed?
I was so curious about this whole notion, right? Because as an immigrant, I've been in this country for only 22 years. A lot of stereotypes that you talk about are the ones that I have probably heard of in the recent past. I did not grow up here. So I was approaching it from a very different angle, out of curiosity and also surprise, right? Because I was like, oh my gosh, is it that big a deal in the US? So I had to really learn that and unlearn the stereotype at the same time.
Wow, what a journey. That's a whole episode in and of itself, right?
I know.
I mean, it's almost like, I felt this while making it. It's like, if I talk about these stereotypes, am I perpetuating them? You know, that's not the goal.
No, but I think you really tackled it so well because you presented a case and then you just debunked it. So it wasn't as if you were reinforcing a stereotype, but for me, I did not know how big a deal it is in American society. And that may be me being naive, right? I'm sure there are a lot of immigrants out there who know of this stereotype, but I can only talk about myself. And that's what was so fascinating. But I could hear disappointment at times. And I wonder if, again, going back to this idea of leaning into seemingly positive stereotypes is something that a lot of us do either consciously or subconsciously, without realizing the harmful impact these stereotypes have.
Well, I think that's the point, is that they are now seeped into our subconscious. This is why racism in America, anyway, is called systemic.
Right.
You know, it's from the ground up. It's the waters we swim in. It's the air that we breathe. And so to take a step back and not only talk about some of these, but to point to them boldly with, you know, and unapologetically. It's not everyone's cup of tea. The people who listen to my podcast are like ready for that on a regular basis. But there are more nuanced ways, right, of course, to talk about these things. But why? Who knows how long we will all have this like very winding down precious moment where Black and Brown voices are invited to the rooms to speak at all. So we might as well say it boldly. That's how I feel. And I would also say for you that like these might be American stereotypes, but people of color all over the world, especially darker skinned people of color, are dealing with their own versions of stereotypes, of their own versions of harm and systemic racism as well. Mm-hmm. Inarguably, you know, darker skinned people of color are treated the worst.
Yeah.
Everywhere.
Everywhere.
So I'd be super curious to learn what systemic, what waters you're swimming in when it comes to some of those stereotypes where you're from as well.
Yeah, I know that's fascinating. You and I could have a different conversation on your podcast about that.
Yes, for sure.
Mara, I want to go back. In fact, I want to connect your music and your podcast. Now, as a musician, sound is your medium, right? But in homegoings, there are moments where you sometimes leave space for silence and reflection. How do you decide when to let silence speak instead of words?
There's just some beautiful saying out there that's like, God shows up in the empty spaces. And I think even Quincy Jones, this great musical producer, used to say something to the effect, this is not an accurate quote, but when it comes to making music, you have to leave room for God. For me, that shows up in the podcast in moments where I feel it's very important for the audience member and the listener to make up their own damn mind about what I'm saying.
Oh, so you're allowing people in that silence to ruminate and reflect?
Yes, to ruminate, to reflect, to disagree with me. Whatever it is people do in their own heads, right? To turn it off if it's gone too far for them, or to put a button on it in a way, you know, I'll put those moments in there after I've had quite a bit of heavy scripting or unpacking of something of my own self-reflection, and then really try to leave it up to folks to have theirs. I kind of get really frustrated with podcasts that want to tell me what to think.
Why?
You know, I don't want you to tell me what to think. you got to have an element of journalism to keep my interest in a podcast anyway, where I get to hear the facts presented, the good, bad, and the ugly, you know, some guests to confirm them. And then I get to take away that precious gem that you created and try to kind of unpack that within myself. And I have had people write in and tell me that they then share the podcast with their church group or, you know, this like really old white farmer in the middle of nowhere, Vermont, being like, thank you. I'd never thought about that before. My daughter shared your show with me. And I can only just think that like maybe somebody listened and had a moment of back and forth, because that's how racism works, right? It's like you don't want to admit that you're behaving that way, that we as a society behave this way. It's such a shame for us. And it's such a wound. Your almost instinct is, I would imagine, is to become defensive if somebody's calling out racism as simplistically sometimes and as boldly as a show like Homegoings does. But if you have thought about it and you've taken that time and that moment in silence with yourself to really just like let that seep in, and then you write me, those are the letters that I hang on my wall. I literally hang them all over my work desk, because no matter what, like, that's what matters. And so silence has a big role in reaching people more than just talking and taking up space can.
Have you ever had a moment of silence for yourself?
Yeah, I think we had an episode on season one called Black Men, How Are You Doing? Where I literally just went around asking Black men the question, how are you doing? And nobody would answer me. All the Black men didn't know how. They kept giving me these like life advice stories on, you know, well, you know, what you got to do is, you know, believe in God and stay true to your family and you'll be okay. And, you know, all these things. And I just stuck with the question. It was really just like, yeah, but how are you doing? I'm asking, how are you doing?
How am I doing with what?
Turns out, and sometimes it took me six tries to get like an honest answer just about how you're doing out of, I think about like the barber we interviewed, until eventually he said, I'm scared. I'm really scared.
Huh.
And I remember that being a moment of silence for me, for sure, of just like feeling emotional just talking about it. Like, these are real human beings that we're talking about, you know, and to do all of that work daily to not admit that you're scared is so much extra work for the rest of us. It's so much work. And one of the Black men I interviewed was my husband. And that was also a really important moment, because his answer when he finally got there was, I'm just maintaining. And that changed so much in our house after that. So, I mean, it is the best quality in people to listen deeply to other people.
Absolutely. Oh my gosh. You know, sometimes I think the question, how are you doing, doesn't really fully encapsulate what we are really trying to ask people, right? I remember I was on this panel with another activist and they suggested something. It struck me at the time and I've held it so closely now, is asking people instead of how are you doing, how is your heart today? And that makes so much sense to me, Myra, because if somebody asked me that, then I can really, really dig deep and see where I am emotionally, because the heart never lies. It doesn't hold back. So a lot of times when I think of where my emotions are, what I'm feeling, I always think about how my heart is doing instead of how I am doing.
That's great. And that is also a massive privilege, though, in a way, that you're able to tap into that. Because I think what this episode pointed out more than anything is just how difficult it is to even feel the permission to get there. Like, you know, I have a white friend I was kind of paying attention to the other day who has gone through something really hard. And I just watched her like call up her mother and her sister while we were sitting there after we'd been talking about her hard situation for about an hour and a half. Call up her mother and sister and be like, what are you doing? And having them say something and her say, okay, well, I need you to stop soon because I really need you. And having them agree to it and then call back and then her, you know, go off for another hour and a half and talk with them about it. And I don't know that white people understand how lucky they are to have such a fluid demand of their needs and command of their needs regularly, and then to literally have your own husband not be able to understand that when you're asking, how are you doing, you are asking what is on your heart, because I love you and I care about you. And of course, I want to know how you're actually doing. But to even to me, and especially with a microphone, the posturing and the hiding and the lack of access to that command of emotion or sense of self, or the ability to say, can you come here? I really need you right now. I mean, when's the last time that you said that to someone?
I don't remember.
Right. I can't imagine saying that to someone. That's something to work on too, right? We all deserve to have a command of our emotions and our needs, but just the fact that culturally it's not automatically baked in.
I would say this though. I feel like in a household, in an immigrant household, we are almost reinforcing ourselves not to open up, not to be honest, not to be emotional. It's like we've burdened ourselves with this notion of we have to keep it together for our kids, for our future generations, because we have to make this work. We took a risk. We came here. We left everything. We are a minority. I am a Muslim woman living in the US. Imagine the kind of trauma that I have to go through just watching TV sometimes. But we just try to keep it together. That's something that we keep reinforcing. So maybe within our households, we should have a space or a ritual or something where we can really breathe and say, yes, I can express my emotions, at least to my loved ones.
Absolutely. And, you know, I can only imagine that journey. But because as an immigrant in America, every story of being here has an actual journey behind it. I mean, if you didn't keep it together, would you have been able to make that journey in the first place, right? But, you know, once you're here, and now that you're here, and now that we're all here, all of us need societal, structural, equitable support and social support in order to feel like we can just breathe. And if that's not there, then
it's not,
it could be a long time coming. It's not. But what you just said sounds so important, is how to figure that out in your household, right? Like taking control over your close circle and individual world of friends and family and making that a priority. And also noting, like, we are not immigrating here anymore. We are here. And there's no need to continue passing this along to our children. And that's just called breaking generational cycles. And that is really hard work as well, because especially the loss that comes with breaking those cycles, you lose a lot of people who felt like support for the grander picture of better support.
You know, Myra, my biggest fear is that 10 years from now, when I sit down with my girls, I will find out in some form generational trauma that I've passed on to them. And I try to be intentional about it. And I try to make sure that I'm not doing it. But sometimes it happens subconsciously, right? Because I am living a life and I do feel the burden of the life that we've created, right? In some ways.
Yeah, I have a daughter. She's 4.5 years old, and we did not care to learn the sex of the baby while we were pregnant. We had zero desire. It was like, what are you going to do? Like, give it back? Like, why? I never understood that. I'll admit, when I learned she was a girl, I was very scared and very sad, because it's very hard. It's very hard not to impart your generational trauma as a woman onto your little girl, because your little black girl, your little brown girls, because the world is just really tough to navigate and survive. It's almost like with a little black boy, I could have been like concretely protecting them. This is what cops do. This is how you respond to them. This is what you do and don't do to say. It's just a little bit more of like a binary instruction, even though, of course, there are these horrible nuanced stereotypes. But with girls, it's like, hey, most of the men you meet by age 10 aren't safe. Hey, you want to be a musician? Please don't. I don't want to tell you what I've been through. Please pick something else. Like, you know, trying to not just see your own mirror in your children is so hard. But it's our job.
It is our job.
And it gets less and less that generational trauma subconsciously as well through each child. So you have less than your parents subconsciously, even though you're worried about what you have, and your daughters will have less. And then their children, should they have them, will have less. And that's also how that stuff works. And hard boundaries are also really important with anybody who's directly impacting that reinforcement of that trauma in you. And you can feel it in your body when it happens. And that's the person to cut off. And then you say to yourself, this stops with me. And you're able to be proud of that moment where you drew that harsh boundary for the sake of your daughter. So it's a lot.
I do want to extend this conversation and bring your music back. Now, I've been listening to the podcast. There's a lot of vulnerability, honesty, boldness. So what kind of vulnerability do you express through your music versus your podcast?
Oh, everything's fair game because it's me. I'm at the center of it. I mean, some might argue I'm at the center of my podcast as well, but I'm not. You know, I try not to be. I try to be a guide. But, you know, in my own music, it's like, I don't know, I've been divorced. I'm on my second marriage. We talk about that in my songs. Being a mom is super hard and super rewarding. I talk about that in songs. It's just me. I'm on the chopping block. My heartbreak. My perspective. On the podcast, I'm a journalist. That is not the way to be a good journalist. I will still jump in, I think, sometimes with more opinion than most journalists have on my show. For instance, I try to think about the Big Black Penis episode. I did take this moment, and it was one I really toyed with cutting, where I said, you know, it's really wild to think about how people in America can both hate us and simultaneously fantasize about our bodies. I just had to take that moment as a Black person and be like, this is all so wild because I'm learning so much every time I make one of these too. I didn't know a lot of what I, you know, learned. And so I will take that moment sometimes to just react. And then sometimes I'll take that moment to say to the listener, just think about that for a moment. And I'll leave the silence there. And I don't know. I need to be protective of the truth. And that's what's most important on the podcast. With music, the truth could change for me moment to moment, minute to minute. And that's more about trying to find storytelling that others can plug into in my story and find, you know, emotionally provoking. Vulnerability does come up a lot in homegoings, but what's interesting is that I don't always lead with that. Sometimes I'll lead with like very simple questions, and it's almost sometimes like people of color have a script as to how the only reason that they've been pulsed to talk to is because of their trauma. So they've kind of got like a trauma script prepared. And sometimes I have to remind them, you don't have to say anything sad. That's not the direction this has to go. We don't have to reach for your pain.
Exactly. I mean, that's what I really liked about your podcast. There wasn't a moment where I felt like you were amplifying trauma or if trauma was at the center of the conversation, right? It was just a simple conversation between two people or three people. And that's what really resonated with me. It's fascinating what you just said about how you are in some ways more comfortable being vulnerable through your music because it's you, right? So expressing yourself is easier for you, which is in contradiction to how I see myself. It took me a while to be vulnerable, to be able to speak my truth, to expose those parts of myself emotionally that I hid for so long because I wasn't comfortable. I just didn't want people to know. Why are you guarding somebody else's vulnerability more than yours?
Yes. You know, the answer for me in that is probably that I've had a really hard life. And that's something I'm just now able to say, now that I'm in therapy, something that was never culturally, you know, part of what I came from, right? I'm sure you can relate.
Totally relate.
Yes. I've been working with my therapist on saying the sentence, you know, my name is Myra and I've had a really hard life. When you've had a really hard life, you don't know that you've had a really hard life because it's just life. But I do know now. And I know that because I'm 40 years old. I know that because I've had, you know, enough time on this earth to compare lives with other human beings. And I think vulnerability can also be a defense mechanism.
How so?
I'll go back to the hard life thing first. I would say this. If you have been hurt and harmed at, say, a level 10, being outwardly vulnerable feels like a level 6. It's not ever going to, you know, the threshold, my threshold is different. So you might be shocked, not you personally, but whoever is listening to something that I do with such excessive and bold vulnerability might be shocked. It takes me a really long time to understand your shock, to the point that sometimes I've really worried about myself socially because I don't know that I understand when people are having a shocked experience or shocking experience with my work.
Hmm.
And it also probably bugs me a little bit about you because I don't experience shock in that same way because life has been so shocking for so long. And then there's also just the fact that, like, you know, if I'm having a hard time with something, I want to talk about it before you do. And that's, I think, what I mean about the defense mechanism thing. It's like, I got a whole show that confronts the nuance of racism. Why is that?
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah. I'm just taking it all in. If you had to choose one podcast episode that really captures your journey, which would it be and why?
Can it be two or it has to be one?
It can be two. It can be two if you want.
Always asking for more, sorry. So two come to mind. One is definitely the episode we did about the biracial conundrum. It's called Never at Home. And my father is Irish, my mother is Black. But I identify as Black. That's how it went down in my household. My white father identified me as Black. He came to us culturally, and he was a very, very poor white kid who'd been in and out of foster homes and lived in Black areas his whole life, you know, in Rockford, Illinois, and his partners were Black, and my mother was Black. And it just wasn't this, like, split feeling. But speaking with so many biracial people for that episode was, that is exactly how they're feeling. Never at home, like they have to choose between, you know, which race they are. And I eventually got so curious that I interviewed my best white friend since age 5 and my best Black friend since freshman year of college. And basically just asked them, like, what do you think about me? Like, how did you categorize me? And so I enter that one a lot, and I felt like that was appropriate. I mean, if somebody asked a question that we were answering about the biracial experience and you have a biracial host.
Janice is curious about something I gather many people are curious about because I've heard this curiosity my whole life. She wants to know more about the lived experiences of biracial people, specifically people whose racial makeup is Black and white, also known as, well, me.
That's when I feel like it's really important for the host to kind of be a character in the story as well as speaking with so many other biracial folks.
Was there an answer that surprised you?
No, there wasn't an answer that surprised me, but just to learn the differences in that dis-ease, right, between myself and the other people that we spoke with. There was a generational difference in how somebody perceived themselves biracially, like, in their school, in elementary school, they would do color counts in the classroom. That's how they would make a more equitable classroom, which would be like, count the Black kids, count the white. And they would joke with her whether or not she was Black or white every other day. Her teachers would do this to her.
Oh, wow.
Speaking with somebody who really kind of didn't realize he was Black, really, because he grew up in New England and with a white mother and didn't have a Black father in his life until college. And the beautiful, like, experience he shared with me of just that welcome. And then speaking with a biracial woman from Jamaica who looks white, presents completely as Caucasian, but she will not say that she is Caucasian because she is not. She was raised by all Black women. She's West Indian, and she 100% is just like, you know, come step to me, like try to tell me I'm white. Like I'll teach you all about colonialism and, you know, everything that I came from and just how each of us, you know, whatever, it's old hat at this point to say it, but like there's no monolithic story for anybody's experience. That was surprising.
Was there an answer about you that surprised you?
I think my friend Naomi, my Black friend Naomi, just how well she understood me was really surprising. Because aside from being biracial, I'm a whole bunch of a lot of unexpected, you know, things. I was always a proud weirdo, as I like to say. And, you know, that comes, I think, with being an artist, like writ large. And she just understood me very well. And she never questioned my Blackness. She just got right in and started braiding my hair and coming to my concerts and being a good friend of me. But learning how much of the rest of the campus at the time, how they perceived me and how much, you know, my light-skinned biracial privilege like pissed off a lot of people and attracted a lot of boys, which pissed off more people and, you know, whatever other people were going through that she never did. She always just loved me for me. And that's why we're still best friends to this day. And, you know, it's so great. I mean, with other people of color, I don't know if you find this, but we don't talk about race that much.
We don't.
We just talk about life.
We talk about life. Yes. Okay, now episode 2.
That one is the one we spoke about a little bit earlier, which was surviving the spotlight as a woman of color. That episode starts with me confronting my manager at the time, because I got signed to a record label when I was 16 years old, basically asking the question, like, why didn't you ever protect me in some of these rooms, in some of these studios? And then kind of delving into, you know, we are in an era where, you know, what's going on with Diddy, right? R. Kelly, Michael Jackson, yeah. The list goes on and on. There's a bit of a reckoning that's finally having permission to happen in hip hop music and, you know, Black music in America. And it's so complicated because Black music in America is also one of the greatest currencies in America for Black culture. So there's a lot of like turning the blind eye to some of these atrocities because we wouldn't want to turn our backs on ourselves. And it's very, very complicated. And so I loved that we covered everything from abuse to financial abuse that's just going on in the system writ large, and then ended it with Madame Gandhi, who is this artist I just love so much, who is figuring it out on her own as an indie artist and doesn't let any men mess with her, goes exactly for her dreams.
This is Madame Gandhi on the track with Rio Bamba. Rio Bamba. The remix for Waiting For Me.
And she is just such a badass and just a great person to talk with as like a kind of an inspiration for the rest of us who've been harmed so much by old systems in the music industry. So that one I thought was really great as well for me, for others like me.
You know, as you said, we could have this conversation for another hour or maybe 2 hours, but I'll wrap it up. In the end, if you were to define the United States of America in a word or a sentence, how would you do that?
I think that we're really lucky and we don't see that. We are so diverse. We have asked historically for more diversity and we've got it. And I have lived in other countries where that is not there and it is deeply felt. We are so lucky. I wish we could just get it together. Because what a lucky pot of gumbo we have going on in this country.
Oh my, I love it. That's so true. Guys, let's get it together. Let's do it. Where can people find Homegoings?
Homegoings is on Vermont Public. You can go to vermontpublic.org. You can go to homegoings.co. We are on Instagram at @wearehomegoings. You can write me at hey@homegoings.co. If you Google Homegoings, you're going to come across this dope documentary made by PBS called Homegoings, which I also highly recommend, but that's not my show. So keep looking. But wherever you get your podcasts is where you can find the podcast. And it also, we have quite a bit of television now that we've woven into the series. So if you'd like to watch vulnerability and see vulnerability, that's also really important too. So check us out everywhere.
Thank you so much, Myra. This was wonderful.
Thank you so much. This was such a joy. I can't wait to hear what you make. And let's just keep having more conversations off the record too, because you're awesome.
Thank you.
It happens seldom, but it does happen. When I sit down with a guest and I feel comfortable enough to really dig deep into my emotions, my thoughts, how I am feeling, and it is cathartic and challenging at the same time. As someone who's guarded their emotions, thoughts for such a long time, I'm glad I was able to do that with Myra Flynn. This episode is produced by me, Sadia Khan, written by me. Our editorial review is done by Shay Yu. Our sound designer and editor for this episode is Hazik Ahmed Farid. Theme music for Immigrantly is done by Simon Hutchinson. Other music by Epidemic Sound. Come back next week for another important conversation. Until then, take care and be kind to yourself.